Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
The devil emails at midnight. It's not just a mood, it's a management red flag. Welcome to Loud and Lifted. I'm your host, Betsy Hamm. Today, I'm joined by marketing executive, two-time author, and workplace truth teller, Mita Malik, whose new book, The Devil Emails at Midnight, breaks down the 13 archetypes of bad bosses and how even well-meaning leaders can slip into them. We're talking toxic positivity versus realism, how to re-engage a disengaged teammate without spin, what to do when you're stuck under a bad boss, and the leadership muscle at the center of it all, self-awareness. This episode is part mirror, part playbook. And if you ever thought, is it them or is it me? Good. We're going to answer that with candor, scripts you can use, and moves you can make today. Welcome to Loud and Lifted, Mita Malik. Thank you so much for being here. Okay, as we're recording this, we're 12 days away from your second book launch. So we so appreciate you being here. How are you doing? Is it easier when you're launching your second book?
Gosh, what a great question. Thanks for having me. I'm filled with like anxiety and excitement. I am a marketing executive and have been an HR executive. So I treat my book like a product launch. So I've been quietly behind the screens at this for a while. The second book, you learn a lot more, and it's still tough to be an author and try to generate revenue from writing. The whole industry publishing has changed a lot. So it's very different than I thought it would be.
I can't imagine. So we appreciate you being here. And when everyone hears this episode, your book will be available. And that's what we're here to talk about today. So hopefully we can push those sales and generate some interest. The book is called The Devil Emails at Midnight. So talk about a great title. Just really catches people's attention. So tell us about the book.
So the title, The Devil Emails at Midnight, What Good Leaders Can Learn from Bad Bosses, and the opening line of the book is, I've been a bad boss and chances are so have you. And so I have been a person who has contributed a lot in the marketplace literature on how to survive a toxic workplace. The number one DM I get is, how do I survive this bad boss, with something very personal and painful, something someone's going through. And it's just awful. And I thought to myself, I've certainly been a bad boss. And what if we all looked in the mirror and thought about the ways that we were not positively contributing to our work environment and doing something that was holding our teams back? Wouldn't we want to change that? And so that's the genesis of the book.
Of the 13 types that you talk about, how many have you actually experienced personally?
Well, all of them. Yeah. So when you read the book, it's 13 archetypes of bad bosses. And I'm the last one. I end with myself. I couldn't write a book about how not to be a bad boss and not have humility and the courage to say I've been a bad boss. And so I go through different moments in my career of different types of bad bosses I've experienced. I say in the intro to The Devil Emails at Midnight, I have changed all the details, timeline. I don't want to shame, name, blame, demonize anyone. I hope that these bad bosses are now good leaders today. And I think that it's context and situation matters. Someone who is a bad boss for me years later could be a good leader for you. We could be on the same team, and someone who's a bad boss for me could actually be a good leader for you, right? So I think those things are important to keep in mind as well. Can they change? I think they can. I listen, I've learned the hard way in my career in life, and I'm sure you can attest to this, is that you can't change anyone. I can't change my husband, mother, kids. I mean, I'm trying to change my kids, but brother, friends, you know, you have to look inside yourself and have enough self-awareness to say, I want to work on this one thing. And so bad bosses have to have that self-awareness. And there's a pendulum. It goes back and forth. Like, I've been a really good leader and a bad boss, and then I've become a good leader again, and something else happens and I'm a bad boss. So that's important to keep in mind too. It's not a permanent state of being a really good leader forever. We give ourselves grace that we're going to go back and forth in how we behave.
Do you think nowadays there's a certain archetype that you see a lot of?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think given the marketplace and how much is happening, I mean, we're sitting in the US right now, whether that's tariffs or interest rates. I mean, there's so many things happening that's affecting business day to day. One of my bad bosses, I also nickname all of them, and you'll see there's a reason for that. Part of my rationale, I think, is that I've always nicknamed my bad bosses, and it is to create emotional distance from them and to say, I could never be Medusa or the Napper or the Sheriff. Like, I could never behave that way, could I? And maybe it's not that in that exacerbated form, but I do believe many of us on a small scale have exhibited those behaviors. One of the bosses I talk about is the cheerleader, and I call him the corporate Pied Piper. People loved being in the office with him, following him around. He was an amazing coach, mentor, wanted to spend time with us. And so you're probably thinking, how is this a bad boss? Like, this doesn't make sense. He was filled with toxic positivity. It was rainbows and lollipops and popcorn and cotton candy until it wasn't anymore, because he was always surrounded by yes people, and whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You can do this. I believe in you. Like this Instagram reel that was just becoming exhausting. And in the book, I talk about this one moment where we've launched this cereal innovation. It's going gangbusters. It's selling so much. And I don't recommend this, but people are eating cereal for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, right? It's going really well. And supply chain comes to us and says, there's an ingredient that we no longer can procure. Like, this ingredient's no longer available for X number of months. We're not going to be able to sell this innovation. And so this is a big blow, because you've got customers, you've got people wanting it to sell it. And so instead of coming up with an alternative plan or brainstorming and thinking about what we could do, he's like, we're going to add $1 million to the forecast for this innovation. And we're like, what? He's like, you can do it. We can do it. What? Let's go team. Let's go. Rallying. And so fast forward to the end of the story, what happens? It's my performance review. I'm sitting with the cheerleader and I don't get a merit increase. I get a bonus that does not cover my Starbucks addiction, and I get a low rating. And he's like, well, you missed the forecast. And I'm like, huh? And so this idea of toxic positivity, and I think it's one of the traits of bad boss behavior that is really damaging that we don't talk enough about. So goals are changing given the marketplace conditions, and yet you still expect your team to meet it at all costs. It's not possible. So I'm working for you, Betsy. You have a goal that you've given my team for this quarter. The 10 things I needed to get to that goal, I only now have 3 things, but you're still like, push, push, push. You can do it, rather than saying, okay, it seems like you can only get to 70% or 80%. What can we do? Like, let's be realistic together. And that is a really dangerous quality when you do not sit down with your teams and have that dose of realism. I'm not saying not to be optimistic and inspiring. I'm saying that realism is really important in this marketplace.
It's not sustainable. To your point, things change and not hitting goals. But if you're not having realistic expectations, then you're never going to be able to achieve success. Yeah. It's just not sustainable. What was the hardest boss to write about?
That's a great question. There's 13 bosses. I'm one of them. Out of those 13, 3 really impacted my mental health. So one of the bosses that was really hard to write about was the sheriff. And he was the well-liked bully. People really liked him, and he was very well networked in the organization. He had like a deputy of sheriffs. I always joke, he was so tall that he could look into the frosted glass conference room and like see who was in there. Like, he could look in there, look over cubes, look into conference rooms. And when I entered when I re-entered the workplace after business school, I decided to reclaim my full name, Madhumita Malik, which has been a source of joy and shame and embarrassment and pride. And a lot of people told me not to do it, just to go by Mita. But I went to the workforce with this name at the time, post-business school. And he, the sheriff, decided he wouldn't call me Modamita or learn how to say it. He didn't want to call me Mita, and he decided to rename me Muhammad. And so it would be like, Muhammad, go get the sales samples. Muhammad, the agency's here. Go check them in security. Muhammad, are you coming to lunch? And even Betsy, as I tell you this story, I like have shame, I cringe, and I'm like, it's horrible because I responded to a name that wasn't my own for longer than I'd like to admit. And I remember one day being in his office. I can remember clearly what the office looked like, where I was sitting. And I don't know how, at this time I'm a junior marketer, I mustered up the courage to say, can you just call me Mita? And he looks at me and he laughs and he says, oh, but Muhammad's so funny. It's just funny. And so that was a really painful one to write. And it's also, it's healing every time I share it. And now thousands and thousands of people are going to read it in the book, but it's a tough one. Like to think about that I was in that position and let that happen to me, although I have a lot of grace and kindness for myself. And now I wonder what everyone else was doing as they watched this happen, particularly his peers and his boss.
How long did this go on for?
I would say like months. Yeah. I mean, I finally resigned. I mean, once it started happening, you know, I think my biggest piece of advice to people is where there's smoke, there's fire. And so when someone disrespects you the first time, it won't be the last. And I actually posted about this in social media recently because if I was to give advice to my daughter or my son, who are still young and not near being in the workplace yet, but I would say to them, like, stand up for yourself in that moment if you can, because bullies can really sense the fear. They can sense, and they like to target people who I believe are more quiet, was more introverted, shy, kept to myself, was really focused on doing the work. And I was not going to cause any trouble because I wanted to be at this big brand name company. And so really to stand up for yourself in them, which is hard. It's easier said than done.
Well, you were young, right?
Shut it down.
You were just out of school. So you have that you're kind of dealing with where you don't want to create waves.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my gosh. That's wild. And even when you tell the story, it just makes me feel so uncomfortable. I just can't imagine having that happen to me. But then also the people around you who saw that, they're just as guilty for not saying anything.
Just as guilty. And this is what people keep saying to me. What do you think will change in the workplace? What do you want to change? What's your biggest hope? And my biggest hope is that we look out for each other. We spend too much time in our workplaces not to care about the culture. And it is the New York City subway. When you see something, say something. And there are power dynamics at work. If I'm the CEO doing something to you, you're not going to necessarily feel comfortable in that moment to do something. But it's never too late to interrupt, to get help, to think of a plan of action, to ask others to intervene on your behalf. And then also just to spend time observing what's happening at work. I do this a lot in meetings and spaces and places, and probably as a child and as an adult, having been bullied, I just have gained a greater sense of empathy. I wasn't born with it, but I just think about that person suddenly seems quiet, or their nonverbals are suggesting something, or they're looking physically uncomfortable. Can I go check in? Can I help? And I hope we all can gain that sense of awareness and watching what's happening at work.
I love that. And it's so true. Sometimes some people are not comfortable advocating for themselves, but maybe you're more comfortable to advocate for someone else. So it's having other people's back. I follow you on LinkedIn and you have some really incredible content. You post a lot of great quotes, some great stories, and you can tell you've been burned quite a few times through the years. So how do you take this? And obviously maybe writing the book is part of this, but how do you make it positive of helping to make sure it doesn't happen in your future, but then also teaching your children?
I mean, even when we think about the title, The Devil Emails at Midnight, the subtitle is What Good Leaders Can Learn from Bad Bosses. And it's a hopeful and positive book. And it's funny because the title is visceral and evokes a lot of emotion, and either you love it or you hate it, right? Because I've had some people, some companies are like, oh, well, we email at midnight. We're not sure we want to bring you in. Well, it's like, let's have that conversation. That's really interesting, that tension there. And it's people have read it. Some early readers are like, this is a really hopeful book. I'm like, that's the point. So even when I think about my social media and when I'm sharing on LinkedIn, I'm sharing these lessons because I want people to know that if you're in a tough spot right now in your career, there is light at the end of the tunnel. We do have agency. We do have choice. If someone's listening today and you're in a tough spot in your career, I'm not telling you to quit tomorrow. People have bills to pay. They need healthcare. It's a tough market. I'm telling you to think about How can you rebuild your self-confidence? How can you find other skills? How can you continue to try to make impact at work and get those points on the resume? And then also part of that is like, what's the overall exit plan, the strategy plan? What are you working on? And so I always want to share stories. Storytelling is the way that we connect and build community. Storytelling is what inspires people to change. And it's also, there's a hopeful message, right? There's like, there's a lot of hot tea, but it's like, okay, so what do we learn from this? Like, we can just rip on bad bosses, or we can say, no, there's actually lessons we can learn on how to be good leaders here.
Do you think any of your bad bosses that are in this, that maybe they'll realize it's them? Do you think they'll read the book? Do you think
that's
a
really good question? I've been asked that a few times. Yeah. You know, I think that some of them aren't self-aware enough to realize that they were bad bosses. I think the three that hurt me the most and harmed me the most, those are pretty specific. I mean, details have been changed. But again, I don't know if they will remember that they did those things and said those things to me. And also, I've worked in a lot of different spaces and places at this point. People forget, when you work for like a Fortune 100 company, there are times in a year you'll have three bosses. Someone resigns, they merge teams, that person moves. You're like, great, I was just working for Betsy for 3 months and now I'm working for Mita. And then Mita resigned and now they don't know what to do. So now I'm working for Jeff, right? So it's that also happens. It's like you have a lot of leaders in your career and a lot of people that you have to work for.
Which chapter was your favorite chapter to write?
Oh, my favorite chapter to write. The one that gets a lot of giggles, because there's some heartbreaking stories and there's some hilarious stories. The napper. This was my boss who fell asleep in every meeting. It could be a large venue and it could be a small venue and people would be like, what? Are you serious? I was like, you can call my mother. She has all the receipts of my career. I talk to my mom every day. And even when I was writing this chapter, my mom was like, don't you remember he said this? This was years ago. And I love that my mom remembers these stories. But the napper, it's funny, right? Like, it's kind of hilarious. It's outrageous. How is this person sleeping on the job, literally? And in the beginning, I had a lot of empathy because I was trying to understand why he would fall asleep. Is it that he's narcoleptic? Is it that he has a substance abuse issue that he's dealing with? Is he fighting with his partner? Is he sleeping on the floor? Like, what's happening that he's doing this? And it's really a story of complete disengagement. And what happens when you have an employee that completely does the downward spiral and is like the middle finger about work, and they're showing up to every day to work behaving this way. And there's that famous quote that says, your culture becomes defined by the worst behavior you're willing to tolerate. And that is what happened, because he was a manager. And so he was also infecting the culture. It just spreads. It's so contagious. And so for me, while that's like a fun chapter to write, it was hilarious. And also, like, I can't believe these things happened. I'm like remembering all this stuff that he did and said. But one of the things I talk about in The Devil Emails at Midnight is that it's packed with research and tips and tools for leaders. And Michael Murphy of Harvard University asks this really powerful question that I included in the book, which is, if someone is so disengaged, why don't we have the courage to take them out to lunch, coffee, hop on a Zoom, and just ask how they're doing and ask them this question: what would it take to make you excited about working here again? Like, what a powerful question just to check in with someone. And we all have feelings. I'm not going to be like, Betsy, I can't believe you keep showing up late and you're never at the team meetings. You don't respond to the emails. Like, in sort of that snarky, like, annoyed way, versus like, Betsy, just wanted to see how you're doing and ask you and stick to the facts. I've observed the following things. I've observed that you haven't made it to the last three team meetings. I've noticed that you don't respond to some of the urgent deadlines that we need, and I have to go to your team members. Like, you see what I'm doing? I'm acting like a video recorder. I'm just being very practical and saying, here are the things I'm observing. What's going on and how can I help? And I wish we had the courage to do that more. You either help someone find the joy back at work, find that spark again, recommit, or you help them move on to what they're meant to do next.
No, I love that. And that's so true. It's seeking to understand. Maybe there's a perspective that you don't have, but I've also been in a situation where somebody just needs to have that freedom to be like, you know what? I don't want to be here anymore for whatever reason, professionally and personally. It's just time for them to move on. sometimes people need that space to be able to have those conversations. And to your point, it's not aggressive. You're not blaming them. It's just seeking to understand what their perspective is.
I got to ask though, with the sheriff, like, where is his boss? Like, how did the napper, like, his boss never saw him falling asleep.
And he did. And at one point she screamed his name really loudly and he woke up in a start. That's also in that chapter. And I just, to this day, I just don't understand why she didn't help him move on. And people have all kinds of excuses. I'm waiting for another round of layoffs. I'm waiting for Mita to resign on her own. I actually can't have Mita leave now because I'll lose that headcount. Her team's carrying the weight. It's fine. Or we have other plans. Or you've heard the litany of excuses, right? 100%. Litany of excuses. But to this day, I'm like, he's falling asleep in your meetings and you're shouting his name, trying to wake him up to get him to answer a question. Like, I don't even get it. Like, that to me, to this day,
that's why
I don't understand why he stayed as long as he did.
Right. Well, yeah. That's crazy. So let's talk about you. You bravely admit that you were a bad boss at times too. So how did you recognize those moments and what did you do to change or make sure that you don't do it in the future?
Sure. So the last chapter is me. I'm the boss who was grieving and couldn't show up for her team. And I talk about how suddenly in 2017, I lost my dad. With one phone call from my mom, my entire life changed. And we don't talk enough about grief in our home, in our community, certainly not in our workplaces. At the time, I had 3-day bereavement leave policy for this company. I was lucky. My team rallied around me and I took 3 weeks off, but that's not the case for everybody. And that's also another wonderful example of, you know, leaders who do the right thing when no one's looking over your shoulder. Like, you don't need to check an employee handbook to do the right thing. Like, someone suddenly lost someone they love, rally around, support them. But when I went back to work, I'll never forget, my boss then asked me like a series of questions, which were totally awful and intrusive. Like, how did he die? How did it happen? Why did it happen? Like, all these things. And then it was like, oh, you have your mojo back. I'm glad to see you smiling. So it's like clear that I couldn't be sad. And I buried the grief. Like, I was like burying it, thinking I could leave it at home, show up at work. And if anyone's been on a grief journey, and grief comes in so many forms, it doesn't happen that way. Grief is relentless. Grief is inconvenient. Grief can explode. And so all of the behaviors I talk about in the book, I started exhibiting. I was micromanaging details that didn't matter. I remember like 30 minutes before a big leadership meeting, I changed all these things in the deck and my team's like, what's going on? I was disengaged, wouldn't show up at work for days and then come back. I screamed and yelled at people. I'm not proud of that. And what ended up happening is during that time, someone who was a very high performer on my team resigned. And to see the exit interview notes was the wake-up call. And other things were happening where people were saying, like, I was in pain. And when you are not taking care of yourself and when you're in pain in any form, that is when these bad behaviors come. It's like stress-induced. Like, that, it all goes back to that. Like, I keep saying that the foundation of really good leadership is taking care of ourselves. Because if we don't take care of ourselves, we can't take care of each other or anyone else for that matter.
Okay. I have to ask about Medusa just because of the name, right? So intriguing.
Yes.
I can't wait to read that chapter. So tell me about Medusa.
Well, there was no one in my point up until that time working for her, not my parents, not my husband, not my brother, not my friends. No one had ever screamed and yelled at me in that way. She screamed, she yelled, she publicly, privately berated, humiliated people. She was the equal opportunity bully. Some bullies divide and conquer, they isolate, right? The sheriff was like that. He was a bully who isolated people. She was like rip roaring on the floor, everybody. She threw a Chanel shoe at my colleague, true story. She would throw pens in meetings, temper tantrums. And what was really interesting about that moment in my career is that for the first few months, I showed up to work scared every single day. Imagine, it's sort of this feeling. I live in New Jersey. We have a lot of black bears that will be around. And like, they'll be, oh my God, black bear in your backyard or on your porch or eating in your trash can. And it's like that, that visceral reaction, the adrenaline rush. So when we're scared, our body has like a visceral reaction. And I was like that every day at work. And so that drove me to work harder. Because I wanted to outpace her. I wanted to overachieve. I wanted to exceed the goals. So she left me alone. But what you end up realizing is that you can't outwork a bully. And she was going to get upset no matter what. And so then you're tired of being scared. And so here's what I'll say. Fear drives short-term results. It absolutely does. Right? I just went through what was happening with me. But then what happens is you start to get tired. You start to go under the radar. You start to think it doesn't matter what I do. She's going to yell at me anyways. You start to slowly get disengaged. It's like that flame in a candle. The light is flickering. It's like fading, right? That's how you feel. And then that's how fear absolutely kills culture in the long term. And, you know, it was a very large company. And I remember the first team she managed was about 12 people. They all left. Within like 18 months, that entire team turned over, was gone. Then they moved her over to a second team of another 12 to 14 people. I was voluntold. I had no choice. I was moved to that team. What do you think happened then? 16 months later, everybody's gone. Again, everyone's left that team.
That's so crazy. So if you have any of these bosses that we're talking about that people are going to read in the book, besides leaving, that's the obvious choice. What are some other tactics or tools that people can use that they're dealing with?
I love that question because I dedicated the book to my kids. And you'll read the foreword when you read the book. And as a mother, coach, friend, leader, I wouldn't advise that you resign every time you have a bad boss. Like, context matters, situation matters. If you are working for the Medusa or for Sheriff or Tony Soprano, who you'll hear about in the book, another bad boss who really impacted my mental health, those are moments where you have to sort of think about, how long am I going to take this? Because I'm losing pieces of myself. Now, if you worked for me many years ago, and I'm sorry, and I was micromanaging Mita, I wasn't throwing Chanel shoes, right? There's sort of a spectrum of bad bosses. So in that case, you might say, I can't stand working for Mita. What am I going to do here? But I can't resign. I can't leave. It's not that bad. What's the plan? The plan is the following. You're going to have an expiration date. You're going to almost do like a vision board. You're going to say, I'm going to work for micromanaging Mita for 6 months to a year. That's my commitment. I'm going to pull up my resume. I'm going to pull it up and actually create bullet points of what I want to accomplish. Isn't that cool? In the next 6 to 12 months. So I'm committing to myself. Take that energy and say, here's what I'm going to do. Get your resume updated. Always, always, always. I don't care if you're happy in your job. Always have the resume updated. Start also networking within the company. Start finding other leaders and peers where you could be doing interesting projects and working with them. And then start to activate your external network. You should always be looking. I mean, particularly in this market, always be looking. But I think that expiration date is important. And then trying to take that energy that can be really, it can create the downward spiral. You can end up becoming the napper. Maybe not to that degree. You could be so like irritated and happy and just start to spiral. So you don't want to get there. And then last piece of advice is when you're in a tough situation at work, whether it's you're being micromanaged, you're being screamed at, yelled at, all kinds of bad boss behaviors that you were the target of, it can really chip away at your confidence. I was just talking to a friend this morning about this. Like, it can really chip away your confidence. And so find something outside of work that sparks joy for you, that helps you continue to maintain your confidence. For me, that's writing. It could be volunteering in the local community. It could be being a coach for your kids' team or for the local school. It could be rediscovering a childhood hobby or just really embracing something new that you can consistently do that makes you feel happy.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing advice. I love that so much. When people read your book, what is the biggest takeaway you want them to have when they're done? Or what do you want them to do?
I mean, listen, after? It's really easy to nickname your bad boss a Disney villain or a Marvel character. I've certainly done that. I want everyone to read this book and then look in the mirror and think about, what if I'm doing one thing that's capping the potential of my team or peers? Am I willing to sit in the silence and just think about that? That there might be one way in which I'm behaving that's not optimal. I think most people reading the book aren't going to be the Sheriff or Medusa, but we're going to have sort of a wide range of behaviors. I want us to take accountability, find one thing we want to work on, and share it with someone at work that you trust and say, I know I have a habit of micromanaging and I really want to work on it this year. And Betsy, I'd love for you to hold me accountable. And I'm giving you the space to do that. When you see me saying that or doing this, please, please say something and help me.
That's so great. And to your point, it makes it actionable and something that's positive. Sure, it's fun to read about the characters.
Yeah. Although
they weren't characters, they're real life people. By the time this episode is out, your book is out. Yay! Where can everybody find your book and more information about you?
Yeah, you can find it on Amazon. You can find it at Barnes & Noble. You can find it anywhere you buy your books, local independent booksellers. And you can find me on LinkedIn. It's my preferred social media platform. I love meeting new people, and nitamalik.com. And I am doing speaking engagements on the book. So would welcome any messages and hearing from you. Thanks so much for this amazing conversation.
Here. I know your life is crazy right now, and I can't wait to read your book. So best of luck with the launch.
Thank you.
All right. Deep breath. If you recognized a boss in those archetypes, you're not alone. If you recognized yourself, that's self-awareness. Own it, repair it, and do better tomorrow. Huge thanks to Mita for the clarity and the courage. If this hit home with you, share it with another woman who needs that backup right now. Subscribe, leave a review, and follow us on Instagram for more leadership advice. And don't forget to pick up Mita's new book, The Devil Emails at Midnight. Until next time, lead with clarity, protect your peace, and always stay loud and lifted.